think.
The fifties.
Okay, we're going to be covering today and next week a Lojong called Lojong Dunma, which means the 7 points on developing a good heart. And this was written by, we know now, Geshe Kachawa, Chikawa. If you have your, I don't know if you have your Tibetan study sheets in front of you, but for class four, his name is the first thing given there, which you'll need to write down on your homework. So what it says is Kadampa Geshe Chikawa. Kadampa is, they were the first Buddhist in Tibet, first Buddhist monks, actually, and they were pretty much started by Lord Atisha when he came to Tibet. They were the pioneers in Tibet, and some of them went to India to study and would come back and share what they'd learned with others, and other people would go and they'd share what they learned. Basically, they taught each other, which was kind of a really neat thing to do. And one of them was Geshe Chikawa. Geshe, as you know, means spiritual friend. The title back then was before Geshe was a degree that you got from studying in the Gelugpa monasteries. It just meant spiritual friend, but it also had the connotation of somebody who'd studied a lot and knew a lot, somebody who could help you. Chikawa probably is the name of the place he was from. So he's called Kadampa Geshe Chikawa. His name is Yeshe Dorje, which means diamond of wisdom. And he's usually referred to as Chikawa or Geshe Chikawa. If you look on the second line of the Tibetan entries, there's Chikawa, but there's also a Chikapa, which is another way that he's known. So the story of him writing the 7-point mind training is a really interesting one. Geshe-la told us that when he began to do research for the class, he was trying to find out who really wrote the 7-point mind training. And we have in the ACIP database lots of catalogs from various places. The catalogs give the names of texts and who wrote them. And some of the catalogs say that Geshe Chikawa wrote the 7-point mind training. Some of them say that that Lord Atisha wrote it. Some people say that a man named Sharawa wrote it. Some people say Maitreya wrote it. Some catalogs say that Tupuang wrote it. Tupuang is another name for Lord Buddha. It's King of the Able Ones is what it means. So Geshe-la didn't know. I mean, he couldn't figure out who had written this. And he asked Ken Rinpoche, you know, who wrote the 7-part mind training? And Rinpoche said, I really don't know. Maybe Chikawa, you know. And then Geshe-la found a biography of Geshe Chikawa. And he was looking through it to find out if in the biography was a catalog, was a list of the works he'd written. And often Tibetan biographies have these lists. A biography of a lama will have a list of the things that he wrote. But what Geshe-la found was a very interesting story about this. Geshe Chikawa began to study when he was around 7. And by the time he was in his mid-20s, he had memorized around 100 texts and was practicing them. But after, you know, doing this practice and really studying them and meditating on them for a long time, he felt something was missing. the final key or whatever it was just wasn't there for him. And then he was introduced to a Lojong teaching by one of his teachers. And this was the Lojong in eight verses, the eighth verse one, which was what we started in the first two classes. And he thought, this is the missing part. This is what I need. And that text, as you recall, was written by a Lama called Diamond Lion. And Diamond Lion, he was older than Geshe Chikawa, but probably alive, Geshe Chikawa thought. So Geshe Chikawa sets out to Lhasa, which is where Diamond Lion lived. And he arrives in Lhasa and tries to find Diamond Lion. But what he finds out is from several people that they were pretty sure that he'd passed away a few years earlier. Well, then who were his disciples? You know, who could I go study from? And the guy he's talking to said, well, there are three of them, but there's a problem. And Geshe Chikawa says, what's the problem? And he says, well, they're arguing over who's going to be the throne holder for Diamond Lion's teachings. The throne holder was a term used then to indicate, you know, when there was a great lama who had disciples, which one of those disciples was going to carry on the tradition to be the throne holder, so to speak. And this news upset Geshe Chikawa quite a bit. He said, well, he thought to himself, if they're arguing over who's going to be the throne holder, they certainly haven't learned the teachings of Diamond Lion. And then he decided he was going to leave Lhasa and go someplace else. And he was talking to this man who was giving him this information and said, well, I think I have to leave. If they're arguing over who's going to be the throne holder, then they haven't learned anything. And the guy says, no, no, you've misunderstood. Their argument is each one of them thinks that one of the others should be the throne holder, not himself. And that was their argument. They couldn't agree about who would be the throne holder because none of them thought they were smart enough to be the throne holder, that one of the others definitely should do it. So this sort of pleased Geshe Chikawa, and he went and found one of the disciples whose name was Sharawa. And Sharawa is on your Tibetan study sheet. Page 6, third line down middle, Sharawa. And we'll go through this lineage in a few minutes. So he asked Sharawa to teach him the Dharma, and Sharawa agreed to do that. So for 12 years, Sharawa taught Geshe Chikawa middle way. He taught the perfection of wisdom. He taught perceptual theory and logic and vowed morality and the Abhidharma. And he also taught Lam Rim to Geshe Chikawa. Now, while he was teaching Geshe Chikawa, Sharawa also taught Lam Rim to other monks and lay people. Teaching to lay people was not a common thing. Lord Atisha taught lay people. His disciple, Drumpton Jay, taught lay people. Drumpton Jay himself was a lay person. He wasn't ordained. So for 12 years, Sharawa taught Geshe Chikawa. And then one day, Master Sharawa, you know, tells Geshe Chikawa that he thinks that Geshe Chikawa is worthy to hear the secret teachings, namely the seven-point mind training. So up to this point in history, this Lojong had been kept secret. Now, it wasn't secret in the sense that Tantra is secret, but it was only passed on by word of mouth from teacher to student. And when Geshe-la was researching the history of this Lojong, he couldn't find out who the author was because the lineage had been kept secret. Now, in the database where we have these catalogs, there's also a text that gives the lineage of this Lojong 7-point mind training. And it was kept secret, too. So here it is. You're going to have to know it for your homework. So it starts out. Let me get my notes here. Well, it starts out with Lord Buddha, Tupong. And then the next person in the lineage is the lineage of activity. And the lineage holder of that that line is also is Maitreya, the future Buddha and a disciple of Lord Buddha. And then several centuries pass, and we have the Asanga brothers. In Tibetan, they're called Tokme Kuche. Tokme is the name for Asanga, and Kuche means brothers. So this refers to Master Asanga and Master Vasubandhu, who were two brothers who lived around 350 AD. And together, they wrote about half of the original texts that are studied in the monasteries. If you don't know the story of the Asanga brothers, their mother had been a Buddhist nun, and she had had a vision that if she were to have children, they would be great leaders in the Buddhist tradition. And the vision told her that she should have one child by a king and another child by a Brahmin. The Brahmins were the great religious leaders of the time. So she did. And those two children were Master Asanga and then Master Vasubandhu. They were half-brothers because they had different fathers. And then some time passes, and we have Serlingpa. And he's known, Serlingpa means the Lama of the Golden Island. Ling means island. When we do the mandala offering, Rebrap, then Ling Shi. Ling is continent in the mandala offering, and Shi is four. But it also means an island. And Ser means gold. So this is the Lama of the Golden Island. The Golden Island is Sumatra. And Lord Atisha, in his studies, had studied a lot, and he was ready to learn more about bodhicitta. And he found out that the world expert at the time on bodhicitta was Serlingpa, who lived in Sumatra. So Lord Atisha takes a long and stormy boat ride to Sumatra from India, and spends a lot of time there learning the teachings on bodhicitta from Serlingpa. And when Lord Atisha was invited to go to Tibet, he was in Sumatra, a student of Serlingpa at the time. So he asked Serlingpa for permission to go to Tibet. And Serlingpa said, yes, you may, but you must write a text, a very important text there, and then send us a copy. And if you promise to do that, then you may go to Tibet. So the next lineage holder is, his name is Joje, which is the Tibetan for Lord Atisha. Lord Atisha's dates are 982 to 1054. And the text that Lord Atisha wrote to send back to Serlingpa was the first Lam Rim. He wrote it both in Sanskrit and Tibetan. And since Lord Atisha was basically an Indian scholar, that Lam Rim is the only original Tibetan text in the Tengyur, the collection of texts by Indian masters who wrote in the Sanskrit. And then the text and the Tengyur were translated into Tibetan. And then Lord Atisha's main disciple was Drumtenje, it's Drumtompa, which I think is in the lineage list here. His dates are somewhere around 10,005 to 1064. It is thought, well, many texts consider Drumtompa to be a tantric deity. He showed up. He wasn't around Lord Atisha all the time, but he would show up to provide things that Lord Atisha needed to give teachings, whether it was money or food or anything else. All of a sudden, Drumtompa would show up with just the thing that Lord Atisha needed. And Drumtenje became a teacher too. So he's next in the lineage. And one of his students, whose name is Potowa, and Potowa's dates are 1027 to 1105. Since Lord Atisha wrote the Lam Rim, then Drumtenje taught that too, and so did Potowa. And Potowa taught it publicly as well as Lord Atisha and Drumtenje. But the Lojong was still taught in secret, just to a small group of carefully selected disciples. And the small group could be one or two and no more ever than three. That's how it was passed on. And then one of Potowa's disciples was Sharawa, who learned the seven-step Lojong from Master Potowa. And then Sharawa teaches it to Master Chekowa. Chekowa's dates are 1101 to 1175. And he received the teachings in secret, but somewhere along the line... Oh, and the reason the teachings were kept secret is because... people thought that the public in general could not handle the teachings. And these Lojong teachings are about how to transform your mind into cherishing everybody else more than yourself. You know, how do you get rid of your own self-cherishing mind? And what the seven-point mind training covers is basically exchanging yourself for others. There's another teaching on that, but that's basically what the seven-point mind training is. You know, how do I get rid of this self-cherishing mind? How do I learn to really care for other people deeply from the bottom of my heart? And it was thought that people couldn't handle that. Most people couldn't handle that. And they wouldn't understand it. They said, no, this can't possibly apply to me. And they would disparage the teachings, which generates terribly bad karma. If you say this teaching isn't any good, you get really bad karma for yourself. And you really can't make any progress in this life if you've done that. So it was kept secret. But Geshe Chekowa thought, well, who am I to determine whether somebody can handle this teaching or not? So he wrote it down. So he is the author of the text, this Lojong text, the written part. But it was passed down, you know, from teacher to student since Lord Buddha's time. Okay, it's been, since Geshe Chekowa, it's been passed on down. We've received it. It was passed on to Ngultru Dharmabhadra, who was a very important lama in our Vajrayogini lineage. There are also some of the ACI courses where we use his texts. And Muldhu Dharmabhadra was a very important lama in Pabangka Rinpoche's teaching lineage. And then Pabangka passed it on to Trijang Rinpoche, who passed it on to Ken Rinpoche, who passed it on to Geshe La, and then from him to me, and from me to you. I've mentioned before, you know, some of you who have been around a while, that it's important to know the lineage of our teachings. When you get to Tantra, you'll have extensive lineages for both Yamantaka and Vajrayogini. So you've got another one here for this particular Lojong teaching. So let's go on to what this teaching is about. It's called the seven-part or seven-point mind training or training in how to develop a good heart. And here are the seven steps. The first one is called, let's see, do you have them in your Tibetan sheet? You do. It's the fifth line on page 6. Lundro Tengi Chutempa. Lundro basically means come before. And the translation, what it really means is preliminaries. Ten is foundation or basis. Chu is dharma. And tenpa means to teach. So these are instructions on the foundation dharma preliminaries. The preliminaries are attitudes, you know, or contemplation we do before we get to the main part of a practice. Lundro, in many traditions, there's a series of practices you do, your lama tells you to do, before you can really begin to study dharma. And they take the form of like 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 mandala offerings, 100,000 mantra recitations, making 100,000 tsatsas, these little clay images, things like that. The number of each one given depends on your lama, what he thinks you need to do. Typically, it's 100,000. There's a monk at Alanda Monastery in France. Lama Zopa told him to do 700,000 prostrations. And he said, okay. Things like that. We don't do those in our tradition, mainly because I think, you know, Ken Rinpoche thought, Trijang Rinpoche thought for his students, and Ken Rinpoche and Geshe La for his, that we've done all these before. We wouldn't be able to hear the level of teachings that we get if we hadn't done these practices. So what do the preliminaries mean as the first part of the seven-point mind training? Geshe La has been teaching us the preliminaries to meditation for the last 3 years. We finished, I think, the sixth, maybe the seventh course in Phoenix last week. And basically, those, what, they're 10 days each, you know, those by now 60 or 70 days have covered what we do in the first 20 minutes after we wake up each morning. It's been in that kind of detail. But that's not what the preliminaries mean here. What Geshe Chaka was talking about we're going to get to that. I won't go over them here. So that's the first of the seven stages. The second of the seven stages is called Nushu Jungchup Kisem Jonghwa. Nushi means main event, basically. Jungchup is bodhicitta. Sem Jonghwa is, Jonghwa is to develop, and Sem is like develop the mind training. And what this is then is the main practice of developing the wish for enlightenment. So we start off with the preliminaries, and then we get to the main practice. And this main practice is exchanging yourself and others. Normal bodhicitta is wanting to reach enlightenment so that we can help others, you know. And that's what we call kunzop bodhicitta. Kunzop is deceptive. So deceptive bodhicitta is the idea that we want to become enlightened so that we can help other people become enlightened as well. And then there's ultimate bodhicitta, which is the direct perception of emptiness. So the main practice is addressing both the development of deceptive bodhicitta, you know, getting this wish to help others deeply ingrained in ourselves, you know, so it comes from the bottom of our heart. And then also to achieve a direct perception of emptiness, which really sets us on the path toward enlightenment. So anybody who wants to be a bodhisattva really has to have both kinds of bodhicitta, and is covered in this lojong. The third of the seven steps is called Kyenen Jungchub Kilam Du Kyerwa. Ken means circumstance, a situation. Nen is a word that means sickness, it means bad. So Ken Nyang is bad circumstances, bad things that happen to us, problems. Jungchub is Buddhahood. Lamdu Kyerwa is very important thing. It means to transform into the path. And so what this third step is about, transforming problems into the path of enlightenment. Lamdu Kyerwa, this transforming problems, is the key thing that we do in Tantra. Whatever problem we have, mental or outside, you know, physical problems, we transform that somehow into a path to become enlightened. The fourth of the seven steps, then, Tibetan is Chechik Gi Nyamlen Tilne Tenpa. Chechik means one lifetime. Te is life, and Chik is one. Nyamlen means the actual practice. So we had the preliminaries, which are lundros, and now we get to the nyamlen, the actual practice. Trine is an interesting word. It means in a nutshell. I don't know if you know the English term nutshell, but it's kind of like a really brief thing, you know, the essence of something in a nutshell. Imagine, you know, a nut like a peanut or a walnut. You open it up and take out the meat, and then if you could put the two halves together, you have a nice little container. So in a nutshell, everything in that, you know, a summary. And then tenpa in this thing means instructions. So what step four is a whole lifetime's practice wrapped up into a nutshell. Step five is lojong peitse. And this, the English translation is how you know when you've reached your goal. The goal is developing the good heart. So that's important for us to know, too. How do we know when we've got there? This practice is going to tell us what to do. And then this part is going to let us know how we know when we've reached our goal. Step six is Lojong Ki Damsik. Lojong is developing the good heart, and Damsik is a pledge. Literally, it means holy words, and that's the word for pledge in Tibetan. So this is these are promises to yourself that you will never give up. Give up what? Give up developing the good heart. And the seventh step is Lojong Ki Lapcha. Lapcha's advices. So step seven are advices or little tricks, you know, for developing the good heart. Now, that seems like an awful lot. This lojong isn't very long, really. And so as you read it, you will begin to wonder what it means. And we're going to spend two classes going through what it is. So what was the first part? The first part is three steps to training in the preliminaries. And if you have your reading, I'll try to find mine. On page 18, the last quarter, you know, bold print, train yourself first in the preliminaries. This is the first line of the 7-point mind training. So what are the preliminaries here? And we've talked about various kinds of preliminaries, none of which are what we have here. Geshe-la in the Lamrim teachings has almost finished. He missed it by a day in Phoenix from finishing the preliminaries. The first actual topic of the Lamrim is finding and devoting yourself to a spiritual master. And then after you do that, the preliminaries to actually beginning the first, what we might call topic in the Lamrim, the first topic is karma. But before that, there are some things that we consider. And that's what this mind training is referring to here. So what are the preliminaries? The first one is to meditate on the fact that you have a very short window of opportunity into doing something now, you know, and it will close quickly. So this is the first preliminary topic in the Lamrim. It's to consider the fact that our life is short, and what we do with this is use a death meditation. And we consider, you know, there are three things about death. You're going to die. That's for sure. The second thing, we don't know when we're going to die. And the third thing is that nothing is going to help us but the Dharma when it comes time to die. The Dharma is the only thing that will help us. So, you know, in practical terms for us, our life is short, you know, and most of us are middle-aged now, whether you think of yourself that way or not. And we have to understand that there's not a lot of time left to practice. I mean, we really have to understand that. And if we don't get it in this lifetime, our next rebirth is probably going to be in the lower realms. Now, you know, I'm saying this to people who probably had a human rebirth, a last rebirth, or otherwise you wouldn't be here. But that's the way we have to feel. It's urgent. We have to do something. I don't have much time left. I've got to practice. You know, these classes aren't going to last forever. Our time together isn't going to last forever. You may have to move someplace else, you know, depending on the job market or what else happens. We just don't know. We don't have a lot of time to study and practice. So that's the first of the preliminaries. The second one is the death meditation itself. Now, death and rebirth are very hard things for us to grasp unless we've studied emptiness. Death comes about because our body has no essence of its own. It is a projection of our mind. We have gained this body due to the way that we've treated others in the past. The karma for having a human body is very specific, and it requires lots and lots of kindness to get one. And then our death comes about because we don't understand how this body works. We don't understand the fact that it came from good acts. And it dies because we've done bad acts. And in Tantra, these two ideas are very, very important. Every time we do something even a little bit bad, a self-cherishing thought, and all of our thoughts have some element of self-cherishing in them. Why? Because everything we experience, we believe, exists from its own side. When that appearance arrives, it arrives with this tendency to see it as self-existent. And unless we've had a direct perception of emptiness, we really buy into that. Now, we can stop and think. And part of our training is to understand that when somebody yells at us, for example, that it's there because we have yelled at somebody else in the past. And there's no other reason. So we can stop and think about it. But the first ideas might not have that component. We might not understand right away that the angry boss or angry spouse is coming from us and not from themselves. And a little bit of irritation even that takes place there plants a bad seed in our minds. And we go through life doing that. And after 7 decades or so, or earlier for some of us, or later for some of us, we basically shut down the energies in our body that allow us to be alive, and then we die. We have the perception of ourselves dying. So we have to realize, the second preliminary is realizing that we create our own world. You know, dying then is just a change in our perception of our world. It's a change in our mental state. It's nothing other than that. And then the third preliminary is to meditate on the problems of samsara. Geshe-la said that he had discovered this kind of translation of samsara as the vicious circle of suffering. I've used that before because he began to use it afterwards. We heard it an awful lot. But this idea is that nothing will go right for us, you know, meaning that nothing will go right for us until we begin to get our three sets of vows and to keep those vows, to practice the vows. We are in a defective realm. This realm exists because we see things incorrectly and treat other people badly. That is the characteristic of where we live. Where we live, of course, is a projection. So there isn't any deity or committee or any other force that has created this world. It comes from our own actions, meaning the world that we experience. The thing that we experience minute after minute, second after second during our day comes from us. It doesn't come from any other source. And if we really think about it, this world doesn't work very well for us. And we have moments where we know that it doesn't work. It's all screwed up. And then there are moments where we forget that, where everything seems to be fine. But that's an illusion. That's not true, because we are constantly generating the reasons for things not to work for us. The good things that happen do eventually go away, and they're gone forever until we generate a new set of causes to have the good things happen to us. So this third step is to think about deeply and constantly the fact that samsara, where we are, is broken for us. It is not going to get us anywhere. And if we submit to that, as we have since the beginning of this time, we will continue to cycle in this vicious circle. So we're sort of like crazy people in an insane asylum, you know, and we need to figure out that we're there because we're crazy. All right. and then take the steps to make ourselves not be crazy. So those are the preliminaries. You know, that's the first line of this text. And now we turn to the actual practice. This starts on page 19, about halfway down. Learn to see all things as a dream. Well, that's interesting. When we begin the main practice, though, there are some meditation warm-ups we need to do. We're going to be doing this practice on the cushions, and then we're going to learn to not do it on the cushions as well. So we take refuge. You know, we ask our Lama for realizations, for the teachings and for the realizations. We do the seven-step preliminaries, which are not the same thing as the seven-step mind training, Lojong, we're doing. And then we begin with a breathing meditation to focus our mind, and then we can begin our actual practice of this Lojong. So, learn to see all things as a dream. Now, this sounds very New Agey. It's kind of nice. Learn to see all things as a dream. Nothing has any nature of its own. Nothing exists at all. It doesn't make any difference what I do. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, or whatever. Just go with the flow. And that's not what this means. Think about a dream. You know, in a dream, what we experience seems to be concrete reality. But our senses are not working at all. There is no eye sense power that's giving us our images. Or if we hear things, it's not the ear sense power. If we smell things, which is unusual in a dream, it's not the nose sense power, and so on. So the things in a dream are not based on an accurate perception of reality. It's not based on a perception of reality at all, at least as far as our senses are concerned. So what this line is talking about is that we must realize that our outer world, and especially our body, our outer world opposed to our inner world, which is our mind, that our outer world does not exist the way we perceive it to exist. That our perception is incorrect. It's an illusion. What we are experiencing is an illusion because the actual data from our senses is not, our mind doesn't give us a perception that matches what the reality out there is really like. And this is true of the outer world and especially our body. We cannot understand that the outer world comes from itself, which is what our perception is telling us. We cannot understand that our body, we must not understand that our body comes from something else rather than the way we treated other people in the past. We have to understand that those perceptions are illusions. They are not true. They are not correct. So we must understand that if we want to live long, we have to help other people live somehow or other. Feed them, take care of them, clothe them, whatever it is. If we want to be wealthy, we have to give our money away. Keeping it in the bank or working very, very long hours is not what makes us wealthy. Giving our money to other people or giving things to other people is what makes us wealthy. It's what gives us what we want. If we want to be beautiful and handsome, we have to have compassion for other beings. And we start off just meditating on having compassion for others. And then we practice having compassion for other people. If you want to get a handsome or beautiful partner or keep a handsome and beautiful partner, you have to keep your sexual morality very, very pure. You have to honor other relationships. There's no other place that a partner comes from. That and Geshe-la's big thing right now that he's been teaching us, you know, with the Lamrim teachings. Go find old people in nursing homes and spend an hour a week with them. You know, that will get you a partner. There was a young man from Mexico that came to these teachings. He's actually Mayan, as far as we know. And he helps an indigenous people named Huichol. They live, it's like a 12-hour drive from Guadalajara up in the mountains. And they're all by themselves. They wanted to keep their culture kind of pure. They used to live down in the valleys, but when the Spaniards came and other Westerners and stuff and began to populate the valleys, they just moved up, up into the mountains, and that's where they are. They have minimal contact with the West, or with people down below, as they might say. But they suffer the same things as anybody else. The diseases they didn't used to have, they now have. And there's a center in Guadalajara where they can come down and get medical help, other help, and so on and so forth. And this young man works there for them. And he gave a talk on that center. And, you know, he was talking about this practice, you know, of helping grandmas. I mean, a lot of the people who come down are old women. You know, so he took Geshe-la's teaching to heart. You know, if you want a partner, go help old people. And he says, I don't have a girlfriend yet, but I've got lots of grandmas. So that was kind of nice. But that's the kind of thing, you know. We have to understand how the world works. The way we think it works is an illusion to us. We have to understand emptiness. And if we don't, we're not going to get anywhere. So what this line is about, learn to see all things as a dream, means that we have to understand the empty nature of the outside world we perceive, and especially our body, that our body isn't going to last forever. And we have to do the things that will give us good health so that we can practice, so that we can take care of other people. We have to have the means to do that, and so on. If we want to get rid of problems, we have to learn what the cause of those problems is and then stop doing the things that are giving us those problems. Geshe-la said his students always ask him what to do about the cockroaches in their apartments, you know. It's like he's some sort of expert on that. And he said, if you want to get rid of cockroaches, help somebody find a place to live. Cockroaches are in your place because they need a place to live. And they're sort of forcing you out or making it unpleasant for you to live there. And that's what you did to somebody else in the past. If you have insect infestations or anything like that, it's because you made it unpleasant for other people to live in a particular place, or you forced them from their homes. Doing the opposite, which is understanding the emptiness, is to find, to help other people find a place to live. Killing the roaches, for example, does not make them go away. If you spray for insects, ants maybe, and they're gone the next morning, it's not because you sprayed the spray. It's because you helped somebody else find a place to live in the past, and all of a sudden that karmic seed ripened. We have to think that way, learn to think that way. We've talked about how telling lies doesn't work. If a lie seems to get you what you want, it isn't the lie that made that happen. It's because you were kind to somebody else in the future. The lie will turn into you not being believed in the future, even though you tell the truth. Something like that. So we have to learn to think that way. And we do it, you know, we do it with traffic, we do it with pollution, problems at work, bad weather, and so on. The next line, examine the nature of the mind, unborn. The nature of the mind is an unborn nature. What we're talking about now is our mental problems. The previous line talked about our body and the outer world, that those are empty. Now, our mind is also empty. Our mental problems are empty of having any nature of their own. The only reason those problems occur is because somehow or other we did something in the past to disturb somebody's mind. Depression, low self-esteem, you know, anxiety, general unhappiness, specific unhappiness, being nervous all the time, worrying about the future, you know, feeling that people don't love you, things like that, all come from not taking care of other people. That's sort of the nature of the universe. It's the way things work. The way things work, of course, is a projection also, but that's the way it is, and we have to learn that. Our mind isn't born, meaning coming from itself. Our mind comes from the way we treated other people in the past. Our mind is unborn in the sense of coming from some cause that isn't our karma. And the next line is one of those really magnificent New Age things. The antidote itself is gone to is. Oh, yeah. What does that mean? You know, you could go to a kind of Dharma bookstore or a cult bookstore or something like that, or a New Age meeting and say, you know, the antidote itself is gone to is, or everything has gone to is, and people would go, yay, you know, and sort of space out like nothing matters again. It doesn't make any difference. But what does gone to is mean? It means that sooner or later, you know, you will realize that things don't come from themselves or from some other source other than your karma. And the wisdom of understanding that itself is empty of having any nature of its own. So this wisdom is a projection being forced on you by the way you've treated other people in the past. It's by your own good deeds, the good things that you've done, by studying, contemplating, and meditating. The antidote to non-wisdom is also empty of having any nature of its own. And the antidote is the wisdom, understanding that. That's kind of circular, but that's sort of the way it works too. You know, the object on which our mind focuses has no nature of its own. Our mind has no nature of its own. The object our mind focuses on when we're thinking about something has no nature of its own. And what we learn from that has no nature of its own either. We have to imbue our minds with that kind of attitude all the time and just keep hacking at it, keep working at it. So that the text here is sort of hinting at the second path. The second path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, the path of familiarization, and the path of no more learning. This second step is kind of like the path of preparation. It starts off with an intellectual realization of emptiness. It happens kind of all of a sudden. The first one that we're talking about, you know, learn to see all things as a dream, sort of has to do with the first path, the path of preparation, the path of accumulation. We accumulate good karma by doing good things for others. And the only way we can do that and make it effective is to understand that our outside world and our bodies have no nature of its own. The people we're doing this to have no nature of its own. The thing that we're doing has no nature of its own. I have no nature of my own, where I is not my mind, right? It's the fourth of the five heaps. Realizing that lets us generate very, very powerful karma. And doing that gets us enough good karma where we can have an intellectual understanding of emptiness, which sets us on path number two, the path of preparation. And we spend that path going through increasingly subtle understandings of emptiness at an intellectual level. So this line, the antidote itself has gone to is, has to do with the fact that the thing that we are doing, this wisdom we are gaining first in an intellectual level and later at a non-intellectual level, itself has no nature of its own. And if the more that we understand that, the more powerful our practice becomes. And then we get to the fourth line of these four, let it go in the essence, source of all things. Let it go has two meanings. Here we try to let go of, you know, we try to overcome obstacles that occur to us during meditations. The obstacles are basically distractions, you know, like liking things, thinking about things we don't like, what we're going to do today, all of those things. The distractions come under the category of excitement. That's one of the obstacles to meditation. The opposite of excitement is dullness. This is like falling asleep or just sort of sitting there doing nothing. And then there's a really horrible form of dullness called subtle dullness, which you're fairly alert on your cushion. You're sitting there. Your mind is clear. There are no distractions. But the object is unclear to you. You're just sitting there. You may have the object in mind, but that's as far as it goes. And that's a very, very dangerous place to be. You can't get beyond that until you clear it up. So letting go in the essence, first of all, refers to these obstacles of meditation. We have to give them up. We can't let them be part of our meditation. And then the second meaning means that we let go. We reach a point in our understanding where we let go of the idea that things have a nature of their own. And that happens on the path of seeing, the direct perception of emptiness. So that's the second understanding of let it go in the essence. You know, things have no essence of their own. Or their essence is that they have no essence, maybe is a better way to put it. Things have no nature of their own. Whatever nature they do have comes from my mind. And we hear this over and over and over again, and we have to keep familiarizing ourselves with it. So we move from path number two, where we're getting more and more subtle understandings of emptiness at an intellectual level. Two, a point where we realize that directly without the conceptual mind. And that realization, the non-conceptual one, the direct mental realization of that, changes our lives forever. Now, when we come out of a direct perception of emptiness, we're back in ordinary perceptions. Things appear to us as being self-existent. But we now no longer believe it. We don't buy into that anymore. Yes, things appear self-existent. The yelling boss still appears to us. High prices, bad traffic, whatever it is, they still appear to us. We still get backaches. And the backaches come from their own side. They appear to do that, but we know otherwise. We don't buy into the fact that those things aren't coming from the way that we treated others in the past. By doing that, we change how we react to these things. We don't react so much in a stupid way anymore. We act in an informed way, mainly that we have to do the opposite of what our normal reaction has been in the past. And that creates good karma for us. So this line, you know, means that it moves us from the second path to the third path, you know, to seeing emptiness directly. The source of all things refers to the fact that the source of everything we experience is our own past actions. That's the cause for what we experience. And the next part, down at the bottom of the page, in between sessions, be a figment of the imagination. This again seems like that we sort of step out into space and sort of wander around not knowing what's going on. But this refers to a specific spiritual level, and it's the Jetopyeshe. When you come out of a direct experience of emptiness, which lasts 20 minutes or so, you are now back into the ordinary world. You're still on your cushion, but you're back in the ordinary world. And now you begin to have realizations. These realizations are called the Four Truths of Aryas. And we understand in a conceptual way, things about the nature of our existence. We understand that life is suffering. Now, we've known that at an intellectual level, but now we understand it at a very deep level, that this existence is characterized by suffering. We understand that the suffering has causes, and we are those causes. And we understand that if we get rid of the causes, the suffering will go away. And then we understand that there is a path, there's a way to get rid of those causes. And these are the four truths of Aryas. And they occur for the next 10 or 12 hours that you're awake until you go to sleep or wake up in the morning. So this direct perception of emptiness is the first correct perception that we have ever had. And then what follows that for the next 8 or 10 hours are these Jetopyeshes, the aftermath, the after thing, you know, the subsequent wisdom that we get, that we realize, having had a direct perception of emptiness. These wisdoms are conceptual realizations, and they are the Four Truths of Aryas. And all the aspects of those. And once that's over, you know, we go to sleep and then we wake up and now we're on the path of habituation, the fourth of the five paths. And this is where we make use of what we learned during the path of seeing and the Jetopyeshe to refine our understandings of emptiness even more, and to use those to get rid of our mental afflictions, first of all, and then to get rid of our obstructions to omniscience, which happens after the seventh bodhisattva ground. So this fourth path, the world begins to appear to us as a figment of our imagination. So this line is talking about the fourth path, the path of familiarization. Let it be a figment of our imagination. And it says in between sessions. So this means all day long. You know, when we're not on the cushion, we begin to see things this way. Let everything be known to us as having no nature of its own, as simply coming from our, from its own side. And then when we get to the seventh bodhisattva ground, then we lose the tendency for things to even appear to us as being self-existent, as coming from their own side. And now we're almost Buddhists at that point. The mental afflictions are gone. And we're in a really advanced state. Now, this is a Lojong text. And the Lojong text is teaching us how to develop the good heart. And as we do this, you know, and the perfection of wisdom, you know, which is what bodhisattvas do, we perfect the act of giving, you know, where we give things to other people, material things, dharma, protection, and wisdom, you know, through teaching. We do those things. We give away everything that we have to others, that we do it at the drop of a hat. Whatever anybody needs, I'll give them. You know, to what extent I can, I'll give that to them. And then we perfect the ethical way of life, that we cease harming anybody in any way whatsoever, not even the slightest bit. And then we learn to control our anger or other negative emotions. And then we really work on getting off on doing good things. You know, we take extreme joy, pleasure at helping others. We're madly in love with everybody else in the universe. And then we finally apply everything else to being able to contemplate deeply. Now, we've already had a direct perception of emptiness, which means that we've gotten to the deepest levels of meditation that are good for us. But we perfect that even more and more and more. And finally, we perfect wisdom, which is the final understandings of emptiness that we can have. And all along that way, we are developing bodhicitta. Now, the direct perception of emptiness is for us ultimate bodhicitta. So we've got that. And we simply use it to develop our hearts more. And what's the next one here? Practice giving and taking alternately. Let the two ride on the wind. Now, this is Tonglen, which some of you know about. This description, this mention of Tonglen, is one of the first mentions in the literature of the Tonglen practice. So being written down here, people didn't know what it was. And they had to be taught that as well, which means, I think, that Tonglen was considered to be a it was taught secretly, even though it wasn't a secret practice. Secret in the sense of tantric practice. Tonglen, you learn to give and take on the breath. You learn how to visualize the sufferings of other people and take them into you. It's like saying, give me your sufferings, I'll take them. And they go into your heart for your own self-cherishing you've kind of gathered there. And those two things meet and there's like a nuclear explosion, fission, something like that, and they are destroyed. You're self-cherishing at that moment and the problems of other people. And then you give back, you breathe out your happiness to all those people. So you're taking in their problems in the form of black smoke or black light, and you're breathing out your happiness in the form of white smoke or white light to everybody else. And you learn to do this on the breath. So you sit on your cushion. Now you're meditating, right? And you just begin the cycle of breathing. You start with an in-breath and breathe in the problems. Let it stay there. The thing flashes in your heart, obliterating your own self-cherishing, which allows you to take care of others more. And then you give your happiness out when you exhale. And you just develop a rhythm of visualizing giving or taking and then giving out your happiness. Taking the problems and giving out your happiness on the breath. You do that alternately, you know. And that's what those two lines are about. Practice giving and taking. It should be alternately and not alternatively, I think. Let the two ride on the wind. And the next one, which seems to be left out here on your thing, it's practice throughout the day in words. On the three lines, about a third of the way down the page, is the second of those three. Practice throughout the day in words. And this means that you go throughout your day. You're walking on the street, you're at work, wherever you are, looking at other people and imagining their suffering and just take it into you. You know, look at somebody else. Take it into you. You hope they don't remain that way all the time. It's a very important thing. You do it walking around the streets of your town, Munich or Hamburg or wherever you are, the hallways of your office. Giving a prayer, you know, that people can get what they want. You take into them your suffering. You look at them, you know, look at their face. Imagine what they're feeling right now. And if it's like a lot of people, they won't seem to be very happy. And you just take that unhappiness into you. You take away all the worry that they have, you know, the pressures of work. If they're homeless, the pressures of just staying alive day to day, whatever that is. That's what that line is about. So now we get to kind of a new section, the three objects. It says three objects, three poisons, three stores of virtue. So what are the three objects? The Tibetan is Yul Yi Du, Ong Mi Ong War Mad Sum. Yul means object, all right? So Yi Duong means pretty objects. Yi Ong, Yi means mind, and Ong means to come. So literally, a pretty object is something that comes to the mind. You know, it comes to the mind. It's like you're inviting, please come here. You're nice, you know, come here. And Myong are things that aren't nice. Barma means between. You know, the Bardo is the in-between state between death and rebirth. So Barma here, it just means in between. And Sum is three. So these are three things that you like or don't like or are sort of neutral about, in between. And you'll meet these people all day long. There are people or things that you like, either people you like or things like chocolate cake that you like. There are things you don't like, like the annoying person sitting next to you on the bus or wherever. And things that are you are neutral about. You're walking along the street shopping or something like that, and you pass a lot of people, and they don't really register. You know, these are the in-between people. Occasionally you'll see somebody or something that you like, and occasionally you'll see something you don't like. But most of the time there's going to be these in-between people or things that don't really register with you. Those are the three objects. Those are the things that we focus on all day long. And even though you may not think you're focusing on neutral objects, they are registering on your mind and you're generating ideas about them. The karma is probably neutral. But it's not good karma and it's not bad karma. And the most important thing here is that it's not good karma. It could be good. All right. So those are the three objects. The three poisons are Chakdang Timuk Sum. Chakdang Timuk Sum. Chak is often translated as desire, but what it really means is the ignorant disliking of things. Ignorant in what way? Thinking that the thing that we don't like comes from its own side and not from you. That's what chak refers to here. It's ignorant. There's nothing wrong in liking something, liking the food you eat, liking your spouse or partner, liking the people you work with. There's nothing wrong with that. Buddhas like things, but it's the ignorant liking that is the problem for us. It's one of the three poisons. Then Chong is ignorant disliking. Chong basically means anger or hatred, but it's ignorant disliking. Having the wrong idea about where the thing you don't like comes from. It comes from you. It doesn't come from any place else. And Timuk, we've talked about, really means confusion, but we're confused, especially after we've been studying for a while. We're confused about the true nature of things. Things appear to us to come from their own side. We may have somewhere in the back of our mind the idea that maybe they don't. And this is just going through, you know, all day long, not in your meditation cushion or really thinking about it. But we're confused for a while. And that's the ignorance that gives rise to ignorant liking and ignorant disliking, confusion or ignorance. So we have to learn about those, all right? And then the three stores of virtue is the next part of that line. These are our practice of taking away the three poisons from other people all during the day. So we're supposed to be looking at others and taking their suffering from them. Where, right now, their suffering comes in the form of their ignorantly liking things, ignorantly disliking things, and their ignorance itself. So we are taking from them their own three poisons. If we take those away from them, then they won't have them. So we, and they'll be happier. So we are learning in our own mind to care for others enough to take that kind of suffering from them onto ourselves, which means we have to have a pretty good state of mind ourselves to be able to take those things and not let it affect us. It also turns out that one of the ways to make our minds stronger is to take on the problems of others. It helps us. Just like in Tonglen, where we take in other people's suffering, and it enters our heart as black smoke, and contacts the self-cherishing of ourselves that we visualize there, and they ignite each other, and they're gone. They're consumed. They no longer exist. That kind of thing. That practice helps us. Taking care of others, taking on other people's suffering, helps us. It's how we transform our minds. It's how we become a person with a good heart. And we've practiced that. We've already covered that line. Practice throughout the day in words. The order of takings should start with yourself. Now, takings means taking the blame. Where does the blame for the unhappy things that happened to me lie? It lies on me. It doesn't lie on anybody else. It lies on me. If you don't like the things that happen to you, keep your vows better. It boils down to that. You know, think about what a cause might be that has generated an unhappy experience for you, and then begin doing the opposite to other people. And make sure that you change your own reactions when bad things happen to you. Where does the blame for your unhappiness lies? On you. My unhappiness comes from me. It comes from no other source. And that's true for everybody. So we are training our minds to be different. Instead of putting the blame on other people, we are now putting the blame on ourselves. And the way to get rid of doing those kind of things is to be good to others. So we develop this good heart for other people, about other people. We want to help them. We really do want to help them. We love them. We don't want them to suffer. We're taking the suffering on ourselves. You know, we're doing that. We're giving our happiness to them. That's part of our practice. The definition of compassion is not wanting other people to suffer. So we take it on ourselves. The definition of love is wanting other people to be happy. So we give our happiness to them. And that's developing the good heart. And then there's a line someplace. Oh, it's the next one. When the world and those in it are full of bad deeds, learn to use problems as a path to enlightenment. So we look at ourselves and we look at others, the world, the things that other people do, the things that we do are all bad deeds. That's what keeps us in this world. That's what keeps us in samsara. And we have to develop an idea strongly in us, you know, and that's renunciation, to understand that that's the way it is. And you gain renunciation when you say, I'm not going to put up with this any longer. I'm going to change. You know, Michael Jackson, one of his songs, start with a man in the mirror. That's the way it is. You start with yourself. So this step here is about how we take our problems as a spiritual path. And we can, the deception part, what was it here? When the world are full of bad deeds, you know, everything appears to us in a deceptive way, meaning that our mind is deceived into understanding that things come from their own side and not from us. So deception has the idea that, for example, we can get more money by being dishonest or stealing it or being a cheapskate. That's the deceptive way. And it looks to us like we can kill ants and cockroaches and have an insect-free apartment or house. It looks that if we get the guy that sits next to us in trouble at work, that our problems will cease. Those are the deceptions. What we have to do now is take those understandings, those deceptions, those problems, and use them as a way to get enlightened. Um, In Buddhism, a negative deed cannot lead to a positive result. What is the ultimate positive result we want? Enlightenment. A more immediate one is a direct perception of emptiness. And the only way we can get those is to do positive things. Negative things will not lead to a direct perception of emptiness, or Buddhahood, or Nirvana, or even to an intellectual understanding of emptiness. So we have to transform what we do. When we become enlightened, when we become a Buddha, there are four aspects of our body. There's like an emanation body. An emanation body, anybody can see. There's a subtle emanation body that only high-level bodhisattvas and Buddhas can see. And then there's the enjoyment body, and that's the body that a Buddha himself sees. And then there is the wisdom body, which is the mind of a Buddha, which continually perceives the emptiness of everything. And it perceives conventional things as well at the same time. And then there's the Dharmakaya, which is the emptiness of all the other three bodies. Now, a Buddha doesn't go walking around in four bodies or three bodies, but they're different aspects of the same body. There are different ways of looking at it and different ways that different people perceive it. So in order to get those, we have to do particular things. And since we're consumed by doing bad things and have been since the beginning of this time, we can't just stop those because we have the seeds to do them. But what we can do is use them as a way to get enlightened by transforming them. Lama Zopa wrote a book called Transforming Problems, and that's what this is about. That's what his book is about. How we take our problems and transform them into a path, how we use them to get realizations. And one of the things that we have to do is to understand our own emptiness, you know, our Buddha nature, the fact that the emptiness of our mind, the emptiness of a Buddha's mind are identical. There's no difference between them. Our mind can change. Our mind can become a Buddha mind, and that is our Buddha nature. So emptiness is our real protector in this case. When we concentrate on the bad things that we do and understand the emptiness of those in some detail, that will help us gain wisdom. And wisdom leads to the wisdom truth body of a Buddha. Doing good things in various ways leads to the pleasure body and the emanation body. The subtle emanation body and the more obvious one. Our body, for example, is an emanation of our mind. It's not a Buddha's mind yet, hence the body's going to die, but it's an emanation of our mind, just as the bodies of a Buddha are emanations of the Buddha mind. So we learn to use the bad things that happen to us. We recognize they are a projection of our mind forced on us by the things that we've done in the past. We understand that our natural reaction has made those things keep on happening. And we learn to change what we do. We learn to change what our reactions are. And the way we do that is to learn and to take and to keep our freedom vows, to learn and to take and to keep our bodhisattva vows, and to learn and to take and to keep our tantric vows. Then the fact that the world around us has no nature of its own, that becomes our ultimate protector. That will protect us from harm, meaning mental harm. Our wisdom will keep on growing. Our stores of virtue will keep on growing because they're protected by our understanding of emptiness. And that's the only thing that does it. So, that's the class for today. And now we can have questions.